From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On this edition of Fresh Air, Michael Nesmith tells us about being a monkey, creating the prototype for MTV, and becoming a home video entrepreneur. Also, John Horner was the first paleontologist to find an intact dinosaur egg in North America. He also found a series of dinosaur nests. Coming up, he tells us what new insights these discoveries reveal about the parenting and social behavior of dinosaurs. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews Everything's Different Now, the latest album from the band Till Tuesday. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Tequila Sunrise, the new thriller starring Mel Gibson, Kurt Russell, and Michelle Pfeiffer. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. From 1966 to 68, Michael Nesmith was a singer and guitarist playing the role of a singer and guitarist on the TV series The Monkees. This program was about a rock and roll band, and the madcap antics the show tried for were inspired by the Beatles film A Hard Day's Night. When the TV series ended, Nesmith continued his performing career, but he's made the most impact as one of the first and most successful video entrepreneurs. Nesmith produced one of the first rock videos for his record Rio in 1977. He created the prototype for MTV. And his company Pacific Arts Video releases home videos and produces films. Nesmith financed the films Repo Man, Time Rider, and Tapeheads. His company has released on home video such films as My Dinner with Andre, The Official Story, and The Life and Times of Harvey Milk, as well as comedy, music, and experimental videos. Nesmith was able to become an entrepreneur with the help of the fortune he inherited from his mother, who invented liquid paper, the correction fluid. She sold it to Gillette in 1979 for close to $50 million. I asked Michael Nesmith if his interest in rock videos had any connection to the Monkees TV show or the film A Hard Day's Night.
No, I didn't, because I wasn't involved creatively much with the Monkees at all. I didn't really absorb a lot during that particular period of time. My interest in the music video form goes back really to the beginning of the form, which sort of started almost day and date with the first film. The first type of this format that I'm aware of was Paul Whiteman's King of Jazz.
Oh, I've seen that, yeah.
Yeah. Where there was something else going on besides just the performance of the songs. And then, of course, there was the Hollywood musicals of the 40s and 50s, which were really the flowering of the form. To my mind, I don't think anybody's done it better than Disney. He really started off, I guess, in the late 30s and went on from there, probably hitting his stride in Fantasia. Some of it's awful corny, but some of it's just really inspired.
Your first video for one of your songs was in 1977 for your record Rio. And I was wondering what inspired you to do that beyond the movie production numbers and animated films like Fantasia that you've referred to.
Well, the impulse, or the reason that I did it was because in Europe at the time, the way the television systems were set up and the way records were promoted, they would take a picture of a popular artist singing their song and then bicycle that tape around the continent, and that was the way that artists got the exposure and people got to see the artists. So they asked, my record company asked if I would make them a tape like that. And I really sort of ignorantly didn't understand what they were asking for. And when they said, will you make a little film of your song, a little clip of your song, I thought that they were talking about something like Rio ultimately came out to be. When I took it over there and I presented it to the 30 promotion people that were assembled in a room, and they all stood up and cheered, I was as surprised as I was happy, because I didn't realize that it was such a departure from what they were expecting. And that was the reason that I did it. Why I worked in that form was what I explained to you a minute ago.
Mm-hmm. You created the prototype for MTV. You invented something called the Pop Clips, which was, what, was it a station devoted to rock videos?
Well, it was more than the prototype for MTV. It was the first broadcast of MTV. It was a show that I developed for. There was a combination of Warner Brothers and American Express and the cable channel, which you still see the movie channel and at the time, they had an empty transponder. They had Nickelodeon that was broadcasting, and they had the movie channel, and they were looking for something to put on the empty transponder. And I said to them, and our paths crossed, and I said to them, well, I think that 24-hour day music programming can work.
Mm-hmm.
So we developed Pop Clips as essentially the pilot for MTV, and broadcast it initially on Nickelodeon, which was another service that they were providing for children. And the needle just went off the meter. So then we began to build MTV from, those sets and those all of those early pieces of shows and the legal stuff and the operation stuff and the administration stuff. And then they asked me if I wanted to stay and run it and work the channel for them. And I told them, no, I didn't. I wanted to go on my way. So they paid me and I moved on.
Why didn't you want to run it?
I felt like that there was a divergence in what I wanted to do with my career, and so I just made a decision that I was not going to really hit what I swung at there. So that it was a creative decision on my part, and in focusing in on what my objective was to be.
Michael Nesmith is my guest. He first became famous as one of the members of the Monkees. He now runs a very successful home video and film production company. Now, are you still producing rock videos?
No. I haven't made a music video in probably, 5 years.
What do you think of what MTV has become and what rock videos have become? Because in a way, they've become compulsory marketing tools for any rock band.
Well, I'm just not going to get into MTV bashing.
Mm-hmm.
It's too easy. They're obviously not doing. They're not working to the potential of the form. But I'd rather talk about what the potential of the form is. This combination of music and film is something that I think we're going to see more and more emerge on the landscape of the arts. You just get lightning in a box. I think it was Ezra Pound that said that poetry is language charged with meaning. And the early filmmakers found out that music charged the film image with meaning. And I think artists work more to combining these forms, that the standalone rock and roll act who's taken a picture of their latest record in order to market it is probably not going to be a part of the scene. What's going to happen is you're going to see an entirely different type of artist emerge who is able to work in both forms very happily. And as far as MTV is concerned, no, they're not doing that, but then they don't pretend to do that. And the people who show music videos don't pretend to show music videos. As far as whether or not that's a good or a bad thing, I'll leave that to you and the listeners to make up your own minds about.
I think some rock bands have control over what their videos are, and for them a video is a very creative process. And for others, it's kind of out of their control, and they end up with a story that doesn't necessarily match their own concept for their song.
Well, it's not surprising. I mean, the forces that come to work in the contemporary business of rock videos is really not the forces that understand what the objective is. But, you have to treat it fairly, because, a rock and roll band is essentially in the business of selling an audio representation of their music. They're not into selling the audio visual representation. Home video is probably going to give a life to the new type of record. Laserdisc is coming on stream very fast. The CDs already now have video capabilities in the new CDVs, and there's sort of the existence, a kind of a de facto visual image of some of these rock music that's out there, but it's And it's going to help put together, put in place a consumer base for, and a world where the new art form can exist. So, you know, yeah, these people are just making, you know, they're all over the place. You've got a rock and roller on the one hand who knows nothing about film and a filmmaker who knows nothing about rock and roll. They come together, and what they're basically trying to do is make a commercial for a record. But as home video takes over and as it becomes an art form in and of itself, you're going to see more and more of the Disney-like things, more and more of the early musicals.
Michael Nesmith is my guest. I think a lot of people are aware of the fact that your mother was the creator of Liquid Paper, which was the first kind of brush on white fluid that would cover up typing errors. So I think you grew up without much money and ended up grown with a great deal of more money. Was there a big turning point in your life, the kind of before and after Liquid Paper period?
No. No, that really didn't. There was no big swing there. For one thing, to give you some perspective, Liquid Paper currently controls over 80% of the correction fluid market in the United States. It controls that really almost throughout the world, except Western Europe, where we have a very aggressive competitor that that controls the market. My mother started off with this product in the kitchen, and she and I filled fingernail polish bottles with ketchup and mustard dispensers that she had filled with the paint that she had matched to the paper that she was using at the office. And she took this idea of correction fluid from that beginning and turned it into a multi-million-dollar international corporation. Now that all sounds like you wake up one morning and you're rich. It took 25 years,
mm-hmm.
And it was a very slow, difficult process. Her first car was not a Rolls Royce, but her last car was, but it was. The unfolding of the idea over a period of time, and it was the logic of events, which is the mark of success, that pushed it along, that was what happened in my life, and so it was just about like watching a tree grow. At what point did the tree grow in the back of the yard? That's you really just don't have a basis for a question. There's not a threshold or a watershed in these types of things.
A lot of people, when they imagine what it would be like if they inherited a fortune, think that they'd stop working and just enjoy their money. You've never taken that approach, and you've remained very active in production and in business. Did you ever have that fantasy yourself of not working because you had money?
Well, no, it's absurd because I don't work for money. I mean, that's not why you work, is it?
Well, for a lot of people it is. For some people it's not.
Yeah, it's just a question of values.
Mm-hmm. What kind of music were you performing before you joined the Monkees?
I had learned to play the guitar and kind of followed the folk singers of the time, kind of Dylan and Joan Baez and there were a whole stack of people whose names don't even really count as much as those guys do anymore. And then I was working on my own for a while, and then I started working with a bass player, and then ultimately we got a drummer. And by the time I got the job on the television show, I was working in a band of about six people that was kind of a folk review.
No, I read that you sometimes performed under the name of Michael Blessing. Is that right?
Yeah. Well, the people, I made a record deal with some people at Columbia, of all places. The people at Columbia had no idea about the Monkees, and the people in the Monkees had no idea about Columbia, even though it was the same company.
They asked
me to change my name because they thought Nesmith was just not going to work on a record. So I made one record under the name of Michael Blessing. I picked it out of the phone book.
That's funny. Well, I want to talk with you more about your life and your music, but first we're going to take a short break. My guest is Michael Nesmith, and he's the only original member of the Monkees who didn't join their reunion tour last year. He's been busy with his home video and film production company, Pacific Arts. He created one of the first music videos in the 70s and developed a music video format, which became the pilot for MTV. His company has also produced such films as Repo Man and Tapeheads. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Michael Nesmith is my guest. Now, I believe that you auditioned for the Monkees after seeing an ad in Variety. And I was wondering what you had to do for the audition, what the audition was like.
It really was a very typical Hollywood audition. I met the producers. They talked to me a little bit about my experience. Would this thing have any interest for me? Could I play? What was I doing at the time? Then they asked me to come back for a screen test. I went back for a screen test. Essentially the same thing. There was a director on the other side of the camera doing a few questions, which I answered to the camera. And that was it. They gave me the job. I never read a part or anything.
During the production of The Monkees, is it true that Don Kirshner actually produced records of how The Monkees should sound, gave the records to the group, and then the group had to learn their parts off of the records and do their best to sound like the people on the records?
No, that's just a common misconception. Kirshner made a few records, and I made a few records, and Tommy Boyce and Bobby Hart made a few records, and the music was really not even, nobody really thought too much about the music, except that we wanted it to be good and sort of positive and upbeat. They'd asked me to make a half a dozen records, they being the producers of the show. And so I made a half a dozen records, and then when the album was about to come out, they said, you know, we want to put all this music on here. And I said, well, why don't you just put a couple on, and that way it'll be a good broad sampling of all the music that's around. You know, later on, when the thing took off and surprised everybody, and we went out on tour, then we learned to play the songs that we hadn't played.
During the period of the Monkees, you seem to be the member of the group who was the most outspoken and who would sometimes talk about how it wasn't really a band and you weren't getting a chance to play your own music. Were you uncomfortable with the group while you were in it?
No. You're a media victim. But that's understandable, because I encounter this quite frequently. No, I wasn't unhappy there. It was a lovely experience. The television show worked good. It was an enormously successful series. The music was an added kicker. I think that everybody was very surprised that we were so straight up about the fact that the music was just a part of the television show. And there was a certain conceit at the time about rock and roll bands and what a rock and roll band was supposed to be, and because we were playing a rock and roll band on television, everybody just figured we were a rock and roll band. So when somebody stood up and said, "Well, wait a minute, that's don't mix your fantasy with reality here. We're just four guys who are essentially actors who have some musical skills," and so the press went off as if this was some kind of epiphany. I suppose that's fine. It's a little adrift from the truth. I wasn't outspoken, nor was I particularly unhappy.
Were you able to play and sing on your own records?
Oh yeah,
on the Monkees
sure.
records.
Well, to the degree that I wanted to.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't much want to.
Why not?
Well, it just wasn't my cup of tea.
What, the music wasn't?
No, like I said, I'd been a folk singer. I mean, I made maybe a half a dozen records, and then we all got together and played some and everything. But, at the end of the day, it wasn't a rock and roll band, was it?
Right. When the Monkees show ended and the group split up, what did you do immediately?
after. Well, wait a minute. You mean the group didn't split up? It was never a group,
right?
When the show ended, over.
Right?
Well, I just went back to making music. I was real curious about maybe expanding into the country format, and I made some country records and started a small studio in Los Angeles.
Mm-hmm. You had Linda Ronstadt had a hit with your song "Different Drum" in 1967.
Yeah, well, I must say Linda did more for that song than that song did for Linda. She was I think really you have to go into the Peter Asher management period to justifiably say that that was her first hit. I think her first hit was a remake of a rock and roll song. I was glad that Linda recorded "Different Drum," and I was glad that a lot of people heard Linda's record of "Different Drum." But if you listen to Linda's record of "Different Drum," and you listen to my record of "Different Drum," if you're anything like me, you prefer Linda's by orders of magnitude. So,
did people associate you with that and make the connection between the Michael Nesmith of the Monkees and the Nesmith who wrote the song?
Well, only to occasionally send letters, angry letters, saying, "Did you know that guy from the Monkees is taking credit for Linda's song?" Excuse me. They did the same thing about "Mary Mary," a song which I wrote that the Butterfield Blues Band recorded. This was so ironic to, I guess, the Butterfield Blues fans that they wrote mad letters to Jack Holtzman, who was the head of Elektra, who forwarded them on to me. With his reply, which was, "Sorry, guys, he wrote it." Now, did you know "Mary Mary" is Run DMC's new single?
Hmm. Were you surprised when all the members of the Monkees, except for you, reunited recently for a reunion tour? The band that was never a band became a band?
Well, no, because we toured, when the show was on. Took a band out and took our instruments out and went up and played, and it was a lot of fun. Those were nice moments, but I wasn't surprised because they had been kind of hatching the idea for about a year, and I had been trying to work my schedule around so that I could go out with them. When they finally got the dates put into place, it had gone from just a few dates on a few weekends to like 200 dates or something because it was so incredibly popular. And that's when I had to fall out because I said, guys, I can't commit to that block of time. So we worked it out so I could play with them when they came into Los Angeles, and that was it.
My guest is Mike Nesmith. I want to talk to you a little bit more about home video, which is what your company does, among other things. Have you been able to notice any habits that you could generalize about what kinds of movies people actually buy as opposed to rent?
Well, are you talking about market research on the types of movies that sell through?
I mean, about your personal experiences with your own company. I'm assuming here that you do rentals and sales. Is that right?
Well, I exist way up the stream. We focus more on software. We produce and manufacture and distribute, but we don't have any activity at the retail or rental level at all.
Right,
we just sell to those people who do.
Who do, right. So, but you have to keep tabs on what their sales are, right?
Yeah. No, I don't think that there's a... Repo Man was a good example. Repo Man was an absolute disaster at the box office, and yet this thing is almost 200,000 units as far as sell-through. There seems to be a type of movie that people just want to own. The first video that I did, Elephant Parts, has sold quite a bit, and it never saw the light of day. I mean, video was its own window. I think in order to perceive correctly of home video, you have to think of it as its own thing. And to think of it as being a medium for used movies and to try to figure out what used movies people are going to see is to really miss the point of it.
But you do that a lot.
Well, not too much. If you take a look at the catalog, I own all the... I do happen to have the video rights to My Dinner with Andre, and I happen to have the video rights to my own films. Outside of that, I move into a different area. We have, for instance, the definitive biography on Martin Luther King. We've got all the Jacques Cousteau films. I've got Agatha Christie mysteries as a series. Really, I approached the video business as the book business.
What made you realize when you were getting started in home video that there was going to be a market there? You got started before most people owned video cassette recorders.
Well, it's a confluence of events, and you know, just in life, you see the computer coming together with communications, coming together with entertainment, and you see all these. There is a profound change that seems to be occurring in just the way we live our life. And if you look at home video and you look at the VCR and you look at the video cassette, you see that one of the things that it provides is an ability to program your own time. And anything that's going to move you beyond the tyranny of time is going to move you really very quickly into the stream where you feel these merging forces that I just mentioned. And once you start to feel those merging forces, you realize you can have a lot more fun doing that than if you're out doing the things that you've been doing all along, such as watching free television. And in addition to being able to allow the consumer to watch what they want when they want, I think that this medium also it looks like it's going to be a distribution medium for types of properties and types of artworks that, number one, haven't even been defined yet, and number two, will have a completely different support base in the form of advertising. This is something that sends a lot of people screaming from the room, but it's just the writing on the wall. I mean, there's going to be ad-supported home video, and I think it's going to be a very salutary thing. I'm not talking about putting an ad in the middle of Treasure of the Sierra Madre. I'm talking about, you know, an ad for Motorcraft and Purelator products on the latest drag racing tape. And, you know, to a lot of people, and oddly enough, to the media more than almost anyone else, this is a hidden phenomena. We're selling millions of tapes, and we're making millions of dollars on a consumer base that has 65 million VCRs in place, representing, you know, 130, 140 million people in this country. And it's more and more people are using this video to watch things, but they're not watching used movies. They're looking for these book-like products. And so you see the Sports Illustrated tapes and the Jane Fonda tapes, and you see the tapes like that come along, and they go up into numbers that are astronomical, and it doesn't seem like anybody even knows that that's happening. Movies are just really not a part of what video is all about.
Well, let me just ask you this. Have you ever thought of distributing the videos of the old Monkey shows, buying up the rights to that?
They're already out on Columbia. I've thought about it. I would like to put out Head, because I think that was a good film. And I'm probably going to put my television show out, Television Parts. Recycling television shows is about the same as recycling movies. It doesn't, you know, you really don't speak to the form. It's not until you speak to the form and you understand where it sits in this in the new technologies that you really start to do any good. And otherwise, you're just brokering old stuff. Turn into an antique dealer. I'm not interested in that.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us about your work. Thank you.
Okay.
Michael Nesmith is the head of Pacific Arts Video. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, I'll speak with basketball Hall of Famer Walt Frazier. This is the Run DMC hit of Michael Nesmith's song, Mary Mary.
Mary Mary, why you bugging? Mary Mary, I need your hugging.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. While digging in the Montana Badlands, paleontologist John Horner made discoveries that changed our conception of the life of dinosaurs. He found an intact dinosaur egg, the first one ever discovered in North America, and found a series of dinosaur nests. Coming up, he tells us why these were such important discoveries. Autobiography and songwriting don't always mix successfully, and rock critic Ken Tucker believes it's a mixture that too often turns into embarrassing self-absorption. But Ken thinks he's found an exception, coming up a review of Everything's Different Now, the new album from Amy Mann and the band Till Tuesday. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Tequila Sunrise, the new film starring Mel Gibson, Kurt Russell, and Michelle Pfeiffer. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
This is Brian Naylor. President Reagan today ruled out a pretrial pardon for the Iran-Contra defendants, including former White House aide Oliver North. But the president said he would block the trial use of some classified information that North says he needs, an action that by itself could derail the upcoming North trial. NPR's Nina Totenberg reports.
During a picture-taking session at the White House, President Reagan was asked by reporters if he's considering a pardon for North, a man he's called a national hero. The president ruled out any pardon before trial.
From the very beginning, I said that to consider a pardon would leave, would leave them under a shadow of guilt for the rest of their lives.
But the president said he would block the use of certain classified information that North is seeking to use for his defense at trial.
The things we're blocking are the things that duty requires we block. These are things that are national security secrets.
If the judge in charge of the Iran-Contra case decides that some of the classified material is necessary to the North defense, then the government would have to choose between letting out its classified information or prosecuting North. Mr. Reagan, by deciding to block certain information, has made this choice ahead of time, and the decision could result in some or all of the charges against North being dismissed. I'm Nina Totenberg in Washington.
U.S. officials say the Consul General of Yugoslavia in Chicago and four others were indicted today in an international money laundering scheme. The five men and the LBS Bank of New York were named in a 21-count indictment that alleges the men laundered money they believed came from organized crime activities that was to be used to pay for exporting restricted high technology and military equipment. The scheme allegedly involved $1.5 million. U.S. and Italian authorities today announced a sweep of mafia crime families. They say they've charged more than 200 people in a joint undercover operation targeting international cocaine and drug trafficking rings. Arrests are reportedly being made in 8 American and 3 Italian cities. In New York, 16 reputed members of the Gambino crime family were charged today with murder, extortion, and loan sharking. John Gotti, the reputed boss of the family, was named as an unindicted co-conspirator in the case brought by the Manhattan District Attorney's Office. Andy Lancet has more.
The indictment accuses the 16 of running an illegal casino and terrorizing residents on Manhattan's East Side. Two of the reputed crime family members were also charged with killing a competitor and dumping his body in the East River. The 50-count indictment is the first of its kind for the New York City Police Department and Manhattan District Attorney Robert Morgenthau under the state's new OCA, or Organized Crime and Control Act. The measure is modeled after the federal RICO, or Organized Crime Statute. According to the indictment, the 16 were involved in driving residents from two apartment buildings, taking over two gas stations and a storefront for their gambling and loan sharking operations. For National Public Radio, I'm Andy Lancet in New York.
Bad weather at Cape Canaveral kept the space shuttle Atlantis on the ground today. We have details from NPR's Richard Harris.
NASA hoped to launch the secret mission this morning. Work crews all did their part to make ready, but nature did not cooperate. There were rain showers and clouds in the early morning hours, and later in the morning, the launch was stymied by shifting winds at about 50,000 feet. NASA crews are preparing Atlantis for another try tomorrow morning. Forecasters say the winds aloft should not be too much of a problem, but now they're worried about winds blowing across the shuttle's emergency landing strip near the launch pad. This is Richard Harris at the Kennedy Space Center in Florida.
Stock prices closed lower on Wall Street. The Dow Industrial Average dropped more than 12 points to close at 2101.88. Declines led advances 4-3. This is NPR News from Washington.
This is Fresh Air. A broken heart has been the inspiration for many a songwriter. Rock critic Ken Tucker has a review of a new album from Till Tuesday that's full of heartbreakers. Here's a sample from Everything's Different Now.
You know just how I feel. You know when love is real. It changes the life that you're living.
Everything's Different Now is an immediately striking album, and its complicated pleasures grow on you with repeated listenings. Its title couldn't be more direct. This is Till Tuesday's third record, but, well, everything's different now. The group has undergone extensive changes since it released its last album in 1986. Formerly a quintet, Till Tuesday is now, for all practical purposes, not a band at all, but singer-songwriter Amy Mann and a gathering of backup musicians. And Amy Mann has given over this album to a series of songs that are consumed with the notion of a difficult, perhaps impossible, but certainly profound romance.
I can't be appointed keeper of the flame without two to carry.
That's Believed You Were Lucky, a song Amy Mann wrote and which is addressed at least in part to her former boyfriend, the singer and songwriter Jules Shear. This is the stuff of pop gossip, of Rolling Stone profiles, but it's also a situation that Amy Mann has made awfully good music from. This new album has an elegantly formal structure. The title song, the one I played at the start of this review, was written by Jules Shear himself, and Amy Mann spends the rest of the album saying goodbye to him. Shear and Mann met, fell in love, and broke up, all between the release of the last Till Tuesday album and this new one. And the parting was, for many of the songs contained here, an extremely ambivalent one. The song here most explicitly addressed to Shear is J for Jules. Its swirling melody combines with its precise images of hair being combed and prayers being said to convey the intensity of a lost love recalled in something approaching tranquility.
I was saying my prayer. That began with a J for Jules. You know I miss you. The lesson begins, but I'll release you. The lesson.
Everything's Different Now operates as a kind of concept album about the Amy Mann-Jules Shear relationship, and if the music wasn't any good, we'd be justified in saying, who cares? But I think the songs are awfully good, artful in their descriptions of passion, betrayal, and remorse, and Amy Mann's singing is wonderfully expressive. She uses her rather cold, flat voice to dampen down the most florid language in her lyrics. It's a vivid example of the way rock music is essentially a mediation between music, words, and the way those words are sung. The earlier Till Tuesday albums suggested this sort of skill without ever really paying off on their promise, while the new one exceeds your expectations. At one point, Amy Mann collaborates with Elvis Costello on a song called The Other End of the Telescope. If anyone's music can stand as a model for the sort of verbally intricate, melodically direct sort of ballad to which Amy Mann now aspires, it's Elvis Costello's vast body of work. On this song, Mann and Costello
take a dreamy waltz beat, and make handsome creative writing dance partners.
There was a time not long ago, I dreamt the world was fire, and all the colors bled away, and that was the end. And in time, I could only believe in one thing, the sky was just phosphorus stars hung on strings, and you swore that they'd always be mine, when you can pull them down.
On this album, there's very little of the self-absorption that mars so much pop music. This Till Tuesday album could have been an embarrassing exposé. Instead, it's an understated triumph, a record whose pleasing balance between autobiography and art reminds me of Joni Mitchell's great 1971 album Blue. But Everything's Different Now is so understated that its beguiling qualities may go unrecognized by a mass audience listening only for catchy tunes and hit singles. Give this record a few spins, however, and chances are you'll recognize many of its emotions in yourself.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for the Philadelphia Inquirer.
So long and sorry, darling, I was counting to forever and never.
This is Fresh Air. Paleontologist John Horner was looking for baby dinosaur bones when he discovered a dinosaur egg, the first one ever found in North America. That was in 1977. Since then, Horner has led a series of digs in the badlands of central western Montana. He was also the first to discover dinosaur nests, where he found more than 500 whole or partial eggs. And he uncovered a tomb that contained the remains of 10,000 dinosaurs, which led him to the conclusion that dinosaurs traveled in herds. John Horner is a curator of paleontology at the Museum of the Rockies in Bozeman, Montana. His book, Digging Dinosaurs, is an account of his excavations. Horner says it's rare to find fossils of young dinosaurs, or at least it was, and he told me why.
It all started back in the late 1800s when people went out and collected a lot of big skeletons for their big museums.
Right.
And that's what they were interested in. And then, you know, the paleontologists came along and they looked at these collections and they said, where are the little ones? People thought that was very mysterious at that particular time. But as we know now, a lot of the people actually would go into areas where there were small things and wouldn't collect them.
What are dinosaur eggs made of that any of them have been able to survive, especially an intact one like that first one that you found?
Well, the egg, in order to fossilize, it needed to get a little crack in it and have very fine sediment flow inside of it. And then that fine sediment turned to stone, turned to rock, and then the eggshell is fossilized around it. So really what you have is an egg with dirt inside of it that's become rock. Some of the eggs that we find actually are hollow inside. Dinosaur eggshell is, the structure of it is almost identical to a bird eggshell. I mean, it's hard. It's not a leathery sort of thing.
When you found this first intact dinosaur egg, did you recognize what it was at first?
Well, I'd seen very little dinosaur eggshell before. And the one that I found was squashed. And I the first thing I thought was that it was some kind of a smashed little turtle or something. And I took it back to the museum and compared it with some other stuff we had and figured out that it was in fact a dinosaur egg.
You found the first dinosaur nests, and you think that you identified a new dinosaur behavior, parenting.
Right.
The first thing that you had to do is to establish that these were really dinosaur nests. What did they look like?
They were made out of sediment. I mean, it wasn't sticks and bushes and stuff like that involved in them. It wasn't like it was on the surface or anything. It was in sediment. And what we did was, when we would find something like eggshell or bones weathering out of the ground, we would dig down into these things, and what we would find is that they were like bowl-shaped depressions in the ground, and that either they had whole eggs or broken-up eggs or baby dinosaurs in them.
What evidence does this offer about parenting habits of dinosaurs?
Well, first of all, having the nests all together showed us that the dinosaurs nested in colonies, which is a social behavior. Also, the fact that we found some nests with eggs in them, some nests with little tiny babies, about a foot and a half long, and we put the skeleton of one of these together, and we could see that at a foot and a half, they should have been just leaving their egg. And then in some of the other nests, we'd find individuals that were 3 feet or 3.5 feet long. And the fact that we find them in the nests rather than scattered around outside of the nests suggests that they were nest-bound. If something does happen to the parent, they starve to death. But it is their protection, because once they leave it, they're extremely vulnerable.
Was this a big surprise to paleontologists that dinosaurs took care of their young?
Kind of was. The problem is that first of all, people classify animals. Animals do not classify themselves. They don't come with tags on them. So
make it easy if they did, huh?
Right. So we have thrown dinosaurs. We call them reptiles. We look at modern-day reptiles and we say, reptiles are cold-blooded. They don't care for their young. They're kind of slow and stupid. And dinosaurs are in there with them, so that's what they're like. And so when we found that evidence for parental care, it was kind of surprising for some people, but not entirely, because most people, at least paleontologists, realize that our expectations of dinosaurs based on recent living reptiles is not altogether valid.
Is one of the most exciting parts of digging dinosaur fossils when you actually start putting together the pieces and seeing what the dinosaur looked like as a whole?
That's pretty exciting. I would say for most people, including myself, one of the most exciting things is when you first excavate the thing, when you first see it. You're looking at something that's 80 million years old. That is exciting. But, of course, if it's just a pile of bones, it's also exciting when you put them all together to see what the animal looked like. And then, again, it's more exciting when you have all the bones together and you figure out where the muscles go and you're able to reconstruct the animal, flesh it out, so you can see what it looked like in life.
Can you describe to us what one of the species of dinosaurs looked like that was pieced together from fossils that you found?
Well, the Mayasaura. What do you mean, what it looks like?
Too daunting to describe, huh?
Well, I mean, you know, it's a bipedal animal. It's big, yeah. Big duck bill, beak on it. Skin texture very similar to an alligator's. We have no idea what color they were.
Any unusual features?
Not with Mayasaura, really.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the duck bills, of course, have big crests on their heads. Horned dinosaurs have big spikes and plates. I mean, they're...
So instead of beautiful peacock feathers, they'd have clubs on their heads.
Well, kind of, yeah. Well, but think of horned animals today, the deer and the antelope and moose and elk. I mean, they use their horns for male-to-male combat and for species recognition. They don't use them for defense. I mean, they will if they're really pushed into a corner and they've already kicked and ran and done everything else. They will put their head down. It's like Triceratops. I mean, most people think Triceratops used its horns to poke holes in the belly of a Tyrannosaurus Rex. And if you think about it for a minute, I mean, it doesn't even make any sense. I mean,
why not?
Well, first of all, Triceratops would have to come in, poke Tyrannosaurus, and then hope that it got out of the way in time, or else Tyrannosaurus Rex would fall on its face. I mean, it's a bad place for a weapon. And even if you think about Tyrannosaurus Rex itself trying to catch something, I mean, here, if you imagine Triceratops running down the street and Tyrannosaurus is running after it. Tyrannosaurus has no front legs. I mean, it has nothing. It just has a big mouth. And here comes a 2 or 3 ton Tyrannosaurus chasing it with no front legs. So how does it catch it? I mean, it reaches over with its mouth and grabs it. And the Triceratops shakes a little bit, and all the Tyrannosaur teeth are still in the Triceratops. I mean, Triceratops, I think, used its horns for display and not for defense. It just doesn't make sense for a defensive mechanism.
Of course, this contradicts all the monster movies I've ever seen.
And I don't think Tyrannosaurus Rex was a predator either. I think it was a scavenger.
It seems to me that the things you've found have been a combination of chance and very hard, determined work.
It's fun, though.
Do you like the chance element in it?
The kind of luck
that you're having to be digging the right place, or you happen to find someone who has a fossil, they don't know what it is, and it turns out to be a dinosaur baby fossil.
Right, and I mean, you can walk over miles and miles and miles of badlands and never find anything.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're just persistent about it, keep doing it, sometime you'll find something good.
Thanks so much for telling us a little bit about your work.
Thank you.
John Horner's book, Digging Dinosaurs, is published by Workman. Egg Mountain, where Horner discovered his first dinosaur egg, has been established as a reserve by the Nature Conservancy. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered and check in with co-host Robert Siegel. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Terry. How are you?
What story is he following?
Well, we'll have a report from Nina Totenberg about President Reagan evidently ruling out a pre-trial pardon for Oliver North of Iran-Contra scandal fame. And that may mean that the question of a pardon for the former National Security Council aide will move over to President-elect George Bush's file. Also, we'll be talking with William Burroughs, the author of Deep Black, a book about spy satellites, apropos of the shuttle launch that's about to take place, which will, everybody believes, be launching a LaCrosse spy satellite into orbit. And we'll also be hearing about the naming of Benazir Bhutto as Prime Minister of Pakistan.
Thanks, Robert. Those stories and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. In the mid-1970s, Robert Towne was considered the hottest screenwriter Hollywood had seen since the studio days. In 3 consecutive years, his scripts for The Last Detail, Chinatown, and Shampoo received Oscar nominations, and Chinatown won the honor. But people wondered about his promise. In the 80s, he made only one film, till now. Robert Towne's back with Tequila Sunrise, and film critic Stephen Schiff has this review.
Robert Towne is probably the best screenwriter in America. And everybody in Hollywood knows it. But that doesn't mean he can always get his films made. His writer-director credit on Tequila Sunrise marks the first time his name has been on a movie screen since 1982, when he wrote and directed Personal Best. And since the box office failure of that remarkable movie, there have been several years when, in Lotusland parlance, Towne couldn't get arrested. I don't know whether Tequila Sunrise will change his luck. It may be too complicated and too unsensational for Christmas audiences. But it's also a fleet, sexy, extremely intelligent piece of movie-making. And if there's any justice, it'll vault Towne back to the top of the Hollywood heap. Tequila Sunrise is about the meanings of friendship. It's the story of 2 Southern California high school buddies who've drifted down different paths. McCusick, played by Mel Gibson, has become a drug dealer, although he's trying hard to give that up. And Nick Freesia, played by Kurt Russell, has become a cop who now finds himself in the prickly position of having to catch his old pal in the act and put him behind bars. The cat-and-mouse game is made even more tantalizing by the woman they're both wooing, Joanne, who's played by Michelle Pfeiffer. She's a coolly beautiful restaurant owner who becomes the movie's moral heartbeat. As she and Nick drift into their affair, Town's screenplay begins to simmer.
And you'd heard about Mac.
Well, sooner or later, you hear everything in a restaurant.
And he's never asked you out?
No. You're still suspicious.
If I was, what difference would it make? You'd talk me out of it.
That's not it.
No?
No. You're just suspicious of any woman who hasn't slept with you.
Joanne? That is a wildly off-the-wall assumption.
What is it, Nick? You need some chapstick or some lip gloss or something? Because your lips keep getting stuck on your teeth. Or is that your idea of a smile?
The romantic triangle at the center of the movie is like a working model of the moral principles Town has been exploring throughout his career. Joanne cares no more for the customary definitions of right and wrong than Town does. Between cop and drug dealer, whom will she choose? The answer is the man who lies the least. Town's characters always invent their own morality. They shrug off conventional rules in favor of a code that's somehow loftier and more stringent, a code that reveals itself only in their deeds. In Tequila Sunrise, the mesh and clash of moral codes is as fascinating as the opulent, twisty plot. Friendship clashes with romance. The law clashes with right and wrong. And the lustrous cinematography and editing keep things at full boil from the moment the movie opens. The dialogue has Town's steely, naturalistic rhythms, at once artless and perfectly honed, and the actors deliver it with a delicious subtlety that'll keep audiences on their toes. Besides, there's something to be said for sheer thespian gorgeousness on a movie screen. Gibson and Pfeiffer and Russell aren't just an acting ensemble, they're a sensory feast. And so is Tequila Sunrise. Its silky textures and quicksilver rhythms give it an amazing tactile richness. You don't just watch this movie, you bask in it.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for Vanity Fair and is a contributing correspondent to West 57th. Here's a look at the next Fresh Air. Next time, going through the hoops with sports writer John Feinstein. His first book, A Season on the Brink, A Year with Bobby Knight and the Indiana Hoosiers, became the best-selling hardcover sports book ever. His new book, A Season Inside, is a year-long journal of a college basketball season. Also, Harry Connick Jr. returns in our weekly performance spot. He'll put a New Orleans spin on the song Goody Goody. And critic Ken Tucker reviews the home video release of Five Easy Pieces, starring Jack Nicholson. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who makes Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Phyllis Myers, Amy Sallet, and Naomi Person. Production assistants from Ed Doherty and Deborah Beagle. Lisa Bruton directed today's show. Our engineer is Thad Kirk. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.